No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in and be part of the conversation at 888-627-6008. And we especially want you to call in tonight. We purposefully do not have a guest so that we can hear from you and hear what issues are important to you and have a discussion about those issues. Right, Maria? Maria,
absolutely.
Are you there?
Yes. Yeah. Maria. Yep. It's that's why it's interesting, though, the evolution of talk radio, because when I started in Los Angeles, the callers were very much a part of the programming and intended. In fact, one of my program directors said, make sure you take a couple calls before you go on your first break so that you mobilize, if you will, the listeners to be callers. And there is a difference, by the way, between listeners and callers. Mm-hmm. Listeners are actually normal kind of folks. Callers are people with bumper stickers on their car. So the average person doesn't put a bumper sticker on their car. Now, keep in mind, so I started in talk radio in, the early 90s. And that was the adage then. Now, if you listen to a lot of talk radio, they don't take calls anymore. It's the host and their opinion and their guests.
Well, I wonder if that's got to do with how divided we've become as a nation, because, I remember that time too on talk radio, and we've never had as much liberal talk radio as we have had conservative talk radio. But, I certainly remember those days in the early days of the glory days of talk radio.
Well, and we'd be remiss if we didn't mention about Rush Limbaugh passing away on Wednesday of this week, who single-handedly revolutionized AM talk radio and did so in the early days. If you recall, he would take callers as the show unfolded. It got also to be the exception for him to have a caller. And how you feel about Rush Limbaugh, you know, his politics is one thing, but something that should be known, when I started my full-time talk radio career, I started in the studios that he started his in Sacramento. And he wasn't there then. He had already gone to New York and was being syndicated. But what a lot of people don't know about is he was a kind man. He was a generous man. He gave money to charity that was unbelievable. He encouraged his listeners to do that. He was known for leaving $5,000 tips to servers in restaurants. Some of those stories are coming out now from people who knew him, because he also was a private person in that regard. And then I should also add, he was a huge, avid cigar smoker.
Well,
and he died of lung cancer.
Yeah. And you know what? I never understood him. I never understood this guy. It's good to know those personal things about him, but I never understood how a totally, pretty much uneducated person with radical beliefs. I mean, said horrible things about women and minorities and other people, how he got to be so popular. But I think it's instructive.
It's the same reason that Trump got elected president.
Right. And I think that's very instructive that we need to look at that because, you know, that really is how Trump got to be president. And I just got a tweet from somebody that said, since you brought it up, Maria, do we have bumper stickers on our cars and what do they say? Now, my car has no bumper stickers.
I have never had a bumper sticker. I do have to say I have a license plate frame that says Harley Davidson.
Oh, God bless you. And I had one bumper sticker in my radical days in the 1970s when I had my Pinto. And I tried desperately to scrape it off when I got rid of the car because I wanted to save it. And, you know, none of us liked, please don't take offense to this because I know you're a Californian, but we didn't like Richard Nixon. And my bumper sticker said, Dick Nixon, before he dicks you. And my neighbor had my absolute favorite bumper sticker of all time. It said, grow your own dope, raise a man. She had three boys. And it said, grow your own dope, raise a man.
That's funny. That I might add that my Harley Davidson license plate frame is all filled with bling. It's as girly as it can be.
Well, you know, we can't go down this rabbit hole because I always get criticized by Karen that you and I get too, you know, like too mushy about talking about all the good old days. But but I got to tell you, I see women that when I first started riding Harleys, that was 40 years ago, I never saw a woman drive a Harley. Mm-hmm. Now, I not only see them drive the Harley, but they're like the coolest Harleys. They're $50,000 Harleys. They're Harleys that have been all decked out. And I know you had my favorite bike, which is a Street Glide.
And
you know, they're not just the like standard Harleys. They're now customizing them and doing lots of other things with them. So God bless you for having that frame.
I guess that's a bumper sticker of sorts.
Yes, it is a bumper sticker.
Yeah. And Wednesday, of course, being Ash Wednesday, you and I spoke about that this week because one of my sons, I thought it was hilarious that I shared with you and my other Catholic friends about him talking to himself with ashes on his forehead and then not. And so I thought that brought some levity to a somber day. I don't know about other places, but at my parish, they sprinkled the ashes on our head, and that came from the Pope. The Pope said, because of COVID, we don't want to. And I don't know why the forehead is any different than the top of your head, because it's the same proximity, but that's what they did.
Well, I didn't go, and I felt bad, because for the last several years, I've gone and gotten ashes. It's something that I started to do again, but I didn't know what to do, and you just reminded me, before I get into my first topic, is that when I worked at the DNC, we had a press secretary who was hilarious, and we had a guy named Frank that nobody liked. And on Ash Wednesday, I was walking down the hall behind Frank, and as I passed Bob, he looked at me and said, damn, I wanted to be the first one to put a cigarette out on Frank's forehead. So I always think of that on Ask Wednesday. But another thing, I want to tell you a little story about, because, you know, I think we have to have respect for each other. And I think that in politics, and I think, unfortunately, that's been waning over the last many years. But there's one guy that I interacted with a little bit who's been in the news this week, and that was Bob Dole. I want to tell you that I first saw Bob Dole, I didn't actually meet him, when I was in graduate school and I started to cover hearings for PL 480, which is a farm bill. And I would go to these committee meetings just about every day. And the only one that I remember coming to every committee meeting was Bob Dole.
Really?
Now, Bob Dole was from Kansas. Agriculture was important in Kansas, but it was in many states. Yeah, there was a guy there was a guy who was the classic politician. He was like something out of Central Casting. His name was Herman Talmadge, and he was from Georgia. And he was a cigar smoking. This were in the days when you could smoke in the Capitol. Mm-hmm. He was a cigar smoking guy that showed up only for chairman of the committee, but only showed up for the people he wanted to hear. And a lot of committee members it was that way. But Dole was there every day, and it just so impressed me that he was so dedicated. And years later, I went to a party at Chuck Manatt's house, and Chuck Manatt was the chairman of the Democratic Party, and he had written a book with a guy named Frank Fahrenkopf, who was the chairman of the Republican Committee. And so they had a book signing and like a little party at Chuck's mansion. And I'm standing there with my boss, a woman named Ursula Culver, who was Hubert Humphrey's chief of staff and knew everybody in Washington. And in walks Bob Dole. Bob Dole looks around the room and realizes there are not many Republicans there, not many people he knows, but he sees Ursula. And because he's got this sixth sense as a politician, he can tell that she's the woman to talk to. You know, yeah. Because, you know, we just figured that if I want to get to, if I want to meet people here, this is the woman to talk to. So he walks up and they get in a conversation about their dogs. That day, that very day, Bob Dole had been given a dog, a schnauzer, that they named Leader. He was a puppy. Mm. And Ursula had a Chesapeake Bay Retriever that she loved. So they got in this conversation about dogs. And I told him, you know, I said to him, Senator, I was so impressed by the fact that when I was in graduate school, you came to everything. And he looked at me like I was crazy and said, that's my job. Aww. And you know, and I'm like, yeah, but it's everybody else's job too. And you were the only one doing it. But anyway, a great memory for me is walking out of the party, a limousine pulls up and the rear window goes down and Dole yells out the window, hey, Ursula, you want to meet Leader? And the two of us got in the back of his limousine and played with the dog for like 10 minutes and talked to him. And he was so gracious. And I know he's been diagnosed with stage 4 cancer.
Yes.
The president went to see him yesterday.
Yes. That – if our listeners don't know that, why don't you share that? Because I heard that this morning. I was like, that is awesome.
Yeah. And a guy I had very deep respect for. There were many Republicans in those days that I have respect for, and he was certainly one of them. Also had a great sense of humor. Not a lot of people know this, but when the whole Monica Lewinsky thing was going on, she lived right down the hall from him and at the Watergate. And he came out to get the morning paper one day in his bathrobe, and there were all these TV cameras around Lewinsky's apartment waiting for her to poke her head out. And so he looked over his shoulder and screamed back into the apartment, Elizabeth, we're back. So he had a great sense of humor, good guy, honest. And we need to have more people like him on both sides because we're so divided.
I actually interviewed Elizabeth when she was running the American Red Cross.
Well, and I thought to myself, she would be a great, she might have, I used to think she would be the great candidate for the president because, you know, she was a lawyer, graduated cum laude from Duke Law School, head of the American Red Cross, conservative woman. You know, I thought she would have made a great Republican candidate for president, but I guess she didn't want to get in Bob's way. He ran for it 3 times.
That would be my guess.
He didn't leave a lot of room for her. But
even the Clintons waited for Hillary to run.
Exactly.
Yeah. But yeah, she was she had come to Los Angeles to promote blood donations, and she was gracious enough to come in studio, and she was just delightful. she was terrific. So and he's 97 years old though.
He's 97 years old. Yes, he is.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I know.
Jimmy Carter and all those people. Another good guy that I worked for, and he's still going strong. So God bless him. Our prayers are with him. I hope he makes a recovery. I just got another email from Sharon in Pennsylvania asking us who are our dream interview who are our dream interview candidates, guests? Who would yours be?
So
it's a tough question.
It is a tough question.
How many good people out there?
Because it reminds me of when Barbara Walters got interviewed years ago. She said her three misses were Mother Teresa, Princess Diana, and O.J. Simpson. And I had interviewed O.J. Simpson already. I don't know if I've shared that with you before.
No.
I interviewed him after he was exonerated from the criminal trial at his home in Brentwood. And it was a pre-interview because he was going to go live with me on KFI in Los Angeles. And so he asked if we could meet. This is way before the internet and stuff. So I drove to the Brentwood home. He was waiting for me outside. I got out of my minivan and he limped to say hello to me. And then we went inside and we spoke for 2.5 hours.
Wow.
And he told me a lot of things that make a lot of sense. Cause I had already interviewed Alan Dershowitz and I had interviewed, the one from Santa Clara, the University of Santa Clara, Gerald Ullman. So I had some background and I didn't watch a minute of the trial except for when the verdict came. And that was also one of the things that he liked is that I came to him with an open mind. And so he had never done an interview and he agreed to do it. And I went back to the station and told them that it was a go. And the station manager will have to see who can interview him. And I said, that would be me. And he had agreed to let all print and television be present in the studios and record it. And also to let the station owner who had, this is before syndication, had many stations throughout the United States and they could simulcast it. He was very gracious with everything. And the station manager wanted, his answer to me was, frankly, Maria, you cannot speak to the needs of our community.
Because of which community?
He was black and OJ was black and I wasn't. And I said to him, but OJ said that I would be the one who would interview him. And he said to me, you will not. So I went back to OJ and I said, they still want you, but they don't want me. And he said, if you're not doing it, I'm not doing it. And it never happened.
Well, good. Good. Well, you know, I mean, there's so much of that. And that's where some of the divisiveness comes in. And I think we need to find a way around the sexism and racism that's endemic in the system now.
Well, I just attended a Latinx conference for 3 days last week. It was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And all they could talk about is how brown they are. And I finally spoke up and I said, I'm Hispanic and I'm not brown. And they were like, well, if you want to call yourself Hispanic, that's, I guess, okay, if that's what you identify with. And I was like, why do you have to be a color? What is this about?
I think the line's been drawn. I mean, I think the line's been drawn. So now people feel, you know, on both sides of that line that they need to press themselves. I don't get it.
And so we did breakout sessions and I got in a session with a one-on-one with this woman from Argentina who her parents came to Texas when she was like 8 and she's an American and she's bilingual. Spanish was her first language. And I said to her, and she does not have brown skin. And I said to her, do you get this brown thing? And she said, people say to me all the time, you don't look Mexican. And she says, it's because I'm not. And I get it too.
Yeah.
Maria Sanchez, you don't look Mexican. And it's like, I'm not. My family's from Spain. My brother Carlos gets the same thing. He's 6'2", blonde hair and blue eyed. And they're like, Carlos and Maria, you guys don't look Mexican. It's like, we're not.
Well, and that's, that's America, right? We lump people into those categories. My grandmother, who passed, to be honest with you, when she emigrated, my grandmother emigrated to the United States in the 1890s. And she was Italian, but she was Northern Italian. She was blonde hair and blue eyed. If she told you she was Irish, she would have believed it. Mm-hmm. You know, and people used to say that to her too. They would say, her name was Carissimi, and they would say, Mrs. Carissimi, you don't look Italian. And she would look at them and she'd say, I'm not Italian, I'm an American. You know, that was her comeback. But, you know, first of all, let me say, I'm not exactly sure who my favorite interview would be. I think I would have put Dan Rather up at the top of that list, and I'm so glad that he came on our show. But I know who
he was a great interview.
Yeah.
Wasn't
and
he?
I know who he was. If I could choose to be anybody, somebody asked me that one time, like, you know, who would you be? Abraham Lincoln or, you know, William Shakespeare? Or I said, no, I would be Arnold Schwarzenegger, because I think he must have one of the most fascinating lives, because he was the dominant person in his sport. He was the Michael Jordan of bodybuilding. You know, he was the number one undisputed world champion. If you ever get a chance, if you've never seen Pumping Iron and you get a chance to see it, it's probably the best documentary I've ever seen. And then he went on to have a movie career where he became a big movie star, where, you know, what did he have, like 6 lines in every movie that he made? But he became a superstar. And then he became governor of a state with the 10th biggest economy in the world. So he's had, what a life, you know, professional athlete, actor, politician. He's done it all. And I just think he must.
Yeah, including having an affair
he's
with.
The guy I
wait a second.
Interview. What?
That's having okay. an affair with his housekeeper, whom had his child living under the same roof.
I don't know that that's an accomplishment.
But you forgot that part.
But you know, I'd like to interview him. I guess he would have been my favorite interview.
Your choice.
But
you know, who I find fascinating is Bill Gates, but CNN interviews him plenty. So, because I just love what he did with his brain and then what he is doing with the money with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Because, you know, they're helping eradicate polio and malaria and fresh drinking water and literacy. And I mean, they're making a difference on the planet Earth. And I love that about them, both of them, those are priorities for them.
Well,
what's the adage? To whom much is given, much is expected.
Yeah. And you know that was one of John F. Kennedy's favorite, but mm-hmm. you know, that brings me to a topic that really concerns me. And that is that half the world's net worth belongs to the top 1%.
Yeah.
You know, now I'm not sure what you can buy with $100 billion that you can't buy with $1 billion. But, you know, we have to figure out a way to redistribute wealth. And I know that's a hard thing for people to deal with because they worry about what that means to them. But 10% of the world's population controls 85% of all the wealth on the planet. And there's no way that we can sustain this indefinitely. I mean, this is why there are revolutions. This is why there are wars. This is, you know, because, you know, I remember when I first studied economics, we had to learn the definition of economics, and it was the study of the allocation of scarce resources among alternative uses, which basically is saying we come to the table with the idea that there's scarcity, and we try to figure out the best way to distribute things to deal with that. And when half the net worth of the world is owned by 1% of the people, you know, I wish somebody would call in and tell me what they think about redistribution of wealth, because I think we have to do it. And we certainly. Well,
and what do you mean? What does that look like to you?
Well, I mean, what it looks like, I don't know. I mean, I would think there should be a limit to how much money you can make, but doing that is probably you know, has a downside as well, right? You don't want to stifle innovation. You don't want to stifle the profit motive to the point where it interferes with the economy. But there has to be a breaking point. I don't know that. I think I'd have to study more what happened in England, you know, because they have much higher taxes
yes.
on very, very wealthy people. And, of course, a lot of those people, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, the people that have a ton of money, have become expatriates over it.
Correct. So, yeah, it's
that may not be the solution, but I think there has to be, we have to face this. This is one of the big problems we have in the world today, is that we can't figure out a way. You know, the profit motive can be a really good motivator, but it also can be a horrible thing. Look at what's going on in Texas right now.
Yeah.
What's going on in Texas is all about money. Right?
You mean
these guys wanted to be independent. They didn't want to be regulated. They wanted to be off the grid. And they said to themselves, well, what are the chances that it's going to freeze in Texas, for God's sakes? Let's not winterize things. Let's not, you know, follow federal regulations. Let's just go our own way and take our chances. Well, you know, that's great if you're an individual, but if you're a state, you need to be more responsible. So I hate to say more regulation and but wiser regulation and a wiser tax structure.
We're learning that in California with the wildfires and the utility companies that caused them. And you know, and that's a utility that we pay for, and then they're not responsible for the damage that it created. That doesn't make sense to me either. I mean, yeah, they are responsible, but they're not. Doesn't seem like they're going to be paying much of a price. I guess because there's insurance companies involved, but still, at the end of the day, and they said that about Texas, that you pay for something that you're not getting, and then you pay a premium for it when you do get it because of that tier program that they have there.
Right.
And California offered that to me recently, and I was like, no, I'd rather just pay a fixed rate per usage than, you know, take any chances in that regard. And then here we have case in point with Texas.
Well, and you know what? I think we have to do for things like that, I think we have to do what we did to the cigarette companies. Now, you know, I was a smoker. I was a smoker for 30 years. I'm sure I did a lot of damage to myself in doing that. So, you know, and they fed lies to people about cigarettes forever. Yep. I smoked unfiltered cigarettes my whole life, whole 30 years. I never had a cigarette with a filter on it. And you know, I think we have to do the same things we did to them. Well, you know, if you want to, you need to invest in good. We need to give tax incentives to people that want to invest in good things, not clean coal and more oil, but solar energy. You know, look, I mean, how smart do you have to be? One of the very first things I learned in taking an ecology course in college is that all energy comes from the sun. There is no such thing as energy found on a planet that doesn't come from the sun. Oil is stored sunlight. Coal is stored sunlight. Trees, if you're using wood, you can't have a tree without sunlight. So, it really, how long is it going to take us to realize that it's the ultimate power source and we have to do everything we can to make it happen? So I think we need to do more things like that.
Your lopsided thing about wealth is similar, if you want to make the comparison, that today we marked that over 500,000 Americans have passed away from COVID.
Yes.
And that's 1/5 of the total cases in the entire world.
Right.
And we have 5% of the world's population.
Right. And you want to know who they found in England? They just did a study. Guess who the big spreaders are?
Who?
People between the ages of 35 and 49 spread in the United States accounted for 41% of the cases. We thought it was college kids, but it's not. It's us middle-aged people that are driven and are out there and are working and,
And you and I both got our first vaccine. I know a fair amount of people that have gotten their first and their seconds, including my son who had COVID and still has, he's a long hauler. He still has terrible lung respiratory issues, not hospitalizable, but he can't breathe. And it wakes him up in the middle of the night. And then he's in such pain from the burning, he can't fall back asleep. He just got his first vaccine yesterday because he worked through the system because he got it at it's the first two that have opened in the United States, the partnership between FEMA and the state. So one they opened in Los Angeles and one they opened in Oakland this week. And then President Biden wants to open 98 more throughout the country. So because of that, the availability and et cetera, he got in. But I've decided that I need to get out a little bit. So I have two friends that live alone that I have visited with, and I keep my mask on the entire time.
Yeah.
And that's it. We're 6 feet apart. Yeah. And I'm like, that. This is not that difficult. And most people don't. And I'm just like, it's the least I can do. That's as far as I'm concerned. Right. Wear a mask. I mean, we had my son and his girlfriend over for Super Bowl, and she's been both times she's gotten the vaccine, and my son is negative and has the antibodies. So we figured out of anybody, those are the two safest people on the planet. And I kept my mask on the whole time, unless I was eating something or sipping on something. I just thought, it's the least I can do.
Well, if there's somebody out there that can explain a personal freedom thing to me, I'd really like to hear it, because I don't know why we can mandate that people wear seatbelts or that people have car insurance.
Or how about motorcycle helmets?
Or a motorcycle helmet. Car insurance isn't really for you. It's for me. It's for you, in case you hit me. So I don't understand why people see the mask as a personal freedom thing. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I don't understand it either. It's public health. I mean, it's just like the anti-vaxxers, when we used to give our children the measles, mumps, and rubella, inoculations, and then, of course, polio inoculations, that's for public health. It's for the good of the order. And then what have we seen now? A spike in pertussis and a spike in some of those other things. And so now they're mandating. Yes, you have to get your children vaccinated.
Yes. Yeah, I get it.
Because the anti-vaxxers are counting on the herd immunity. Well, that's kind of going away because there's enough of them that aren't doing it. I've been to India. I dispensed the polio vaccine. I saw people, what it does to them. They're called crawlers. They walk on all fours because their limbs are so atrophied. It's terrible. And for us to not do that, just like with COVID and just like the masks, it's for everybody. It's not just about you. We belong to a society.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's such an easy thing to do. It's annoying, but, you know, who the hell cares? If it keeps us safe and it leads to herd immunity, which it will, you know, once we get enough people vaccinated, we'll be safe. And this is not going to end. This is not going to be something that doesn't recur in the future sometime. Mm-hmm. So the more we get prepared for it
now. Well, it's just like the flu.
Right,
the flu. I get the flu shot every year. I didn't used to until I worked for the American Red Cross, and one of our nurse volunteers, her husband got hospitalized with the flu with 104-degree fever and et cetera. Yeah. And she said, I never believed in the flu shot, but I'm not going to miss one now. And from her mouth, I started doing it. I was like, I've never had the flu, but I would like not to. So I do what I can.
I never did it either until I got a cut on my finger and it took 8 months to heal. And my doctor said, that's because you're diabetic. Don't get infected with anything. Get a flu vaccine every year because, you know, what could be a cold, you know, what could be inconvenient for somebody else could be deadly for you. So that's when I started doing it, and I do it religiously too.
So we might have to do that with COVID. Who knows?
Might have to do it with COVID.
I mean, and there's the pneumonia shot too. And then there's the shingles shot. You know, that's what Western medicine does well. The science behind that is good. And so if that's what we have to do with COVID, oh, well. I remember being in Tokyo. This was like in 2008. And everybody there was wearing masks. It was most eerie thing to walk down the streets and see all these people wearing masks. But it's because of their density.
You know what? I used to see Asian people on the metro and other stuff with masks on. And I would think to myself, how damn silly is this? Yeah. It's so silly. You know, and now I feel foolish for having that feeling.
I thought the same thing. Because I traveled on their subway system and their mass transit. And they have police that actually push people so that they get as many people as possible per car. And sure, you should be wearing a mask. You're nose to nose with strangers.
Yeah, absolutely.
But well, I thought it was like a surreal thing because I had never seen it before. But well, I'm from the United States.
Well, and you know, and I had a sister who, because of chemotherapy, was neutropenic. She had no white blood cells. And so I used to think to myself, well, I wonder if that's who these people are, if they're like, you know, people that are in chemo and are just trying to protect themselves. But now we realize they're a lot smarter than we thought, than we were. And, you know, I want to talk about two things. One is stupid Republicans and the other one is stupid Democrats. Let me start with stupid Democrats. And please know, again, for any Californians that I offend here, please accept my apologies. But the San Francisco School Board, did you read this? The San Francisco School Board is going to rename 44 schools, and they include renaming schools that were named after George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. I got to tell you, as a Democrat, I feel these are the kind of things that make people make fun of our party. I don't get it. I don't understand. You know, Lincoln, they want to change the name of Lincoln's school because he supported policies that were not, favorable to Native Americans. George Washington, really? We're gonna get rid of the Washington Monument. We're gonna name it something else. Thomas Jefferson. We're gonna get rid of all the schools named Jefferson. You know, here in Washington, we had a big fight over whether to rename the city. What the what the name of the city should be, and they've decided it should be Washington, D.C., after Washington Douglas Commonwealth, after Frederick Douglass, a man that I greatly admire. But you can imagine that there's going to be a little confusion between having Washington, D.C. and Washington, D.C. There are all sorts of complications with that. So sometimes we just carry this to ridiculous extremes. And you know what? I would have no problem with them putting a plaque in the Jefferson Memorial pointing out that he was a slave owner, or at the Washington Monument. But to try to erase them and rewrite our history, I think is wrong, and I think it's foolish, and I think it's dangerous. You know, this is the very first thing the communists do when they take over, is they tear down all the monuments and they rewrite the history. You know, so I think that, I don't know if there are people out there listening that have some feeling about this, but I think it's ridiculous to go to that extreme. And, you know, I understand why people have strong feelings about this, but where do we
draw? Well, it's kind of similar what we've done in California with, he's a saint now, Father Sarah, who built 9 of the missions. Yeah. And it's come to light that the treatment of Native American or indigenous people was less than to be desired. And so the city of Ventura had Father Sarah on a statue in front of City Hall. They've since taken it down. And there was a Father Sarah in Sacramento, and they're taking that down. It's tough because he did a lot of great things, a lot. And then apparently some not good things. So I struggle with that myself.
Me too.
The Confederate thing is a non-issue as far as I'm concerned. That's...
Me too.
Yeah. But these other people who were people, I don't know who makes those decisions. Who should? Because it's like you and me, Michael. I mean, we're human beings, so we're imperfect by design. That's how humans roll out. And I guess it's to what level or how heinous or what do you say?
Right.
I don't know. I don't have the answer to that. I mean, Jefferson, I can kind of see because he, Sally, and was a slave and it was his mistress and et cetera. But I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tough question. But believe
me, who's the dumb Republican aside from Ted Cruz?
I'll get on to that in a minute. But I just want you to know that when they build your statue in L.A. and the protesters show up because you had a Harley Davidson license plate holder, I'm going to be there to defend it. And you know there would be. You know the minute they unveiled it, that somebody would stand up and say, hey, she was a biker chick, you know. But
made in always America. Opposition. Made in
but,
America.
But made in America, exactly. No, I just want to talk about Donald Trump for a minute, not because of, you know, what he did as president or the Capitol riot or any of that stuff, but that they just did a survey of Republicans. I want to know what you feel about this as a Republican, that 46% of them, almost half of your party, said that if Donald Trump started a new party, they'd go with him.
Yep. I saw that.
I mean, how scary is that?
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible
on the part. Because, you know, on the one hand, the party can't exist with only, you know, 54% of Republicans.
Well, we need a two-party system. So
yes, we do.
And it's not going to come from independents. So the Republican Party has to figure it out. And the more they distance themselves from him, the better. But with that, those poll numbers that came out, was that the USA Today poll that you're referring to?
Yeah.
Yeah. But so now this conservative political action conference in Florida a week from today, he's talking to, you know, Pence declined.
Yeah.
And so I thought, you know, yay. But
I mean, since you brought up his name, I mean, that, you just feel sorry for the guy because he doesn't get it. I mean, who would do this? This is politics 101, that you don't do something like that, you know? And I heard people, when I talked about it earlier this week, there were people that said to me, well, what could he have done from his office in Texas that he couldn't do from Cancun remotely? And I'm like, that's not the point. Leadership is about leading. Right. It's not about, right? It's not
well,
about.
And it's different, too, as, you know, that he's on a trip and then the problem starts. But he left during the problem.
Right.
You know, because sometimes things are out of your control. You don't know. But then you certainly rush back to make it okay. But I find him despicable, too. I just think he's terrible. And and apparently, you know, the trip was planned and they revealed the text between he and his wife with the plans and all that stuff.
Hey, come on, let's all go to the Ritz-Carlton. I mean, come on. You couldn't, if you wanted to sabotage him, you know, that's it. Hey, Ted, you ought to go to the Ritz-Carlton in Cancun. Mm-hmm. Not even in Tijuana or Mexico City or, you know, but Cancun. Let's go to the warm beaches and have a bunch of pina coladas while everybody else suffers. I mean, just... Well,
margaritas.
Margaritas. I'm sorry. I'm a fruity
bad with
drink.
Your cocktails.
I'm a fruity drink guy, you know? So.
Yeah, but I've got two friends in Texas, one in Dallas and one in Houston, and I've been in touch with them all week just, you know, to make sure they're okay. And fortunately they are. The one in Houston, he's kind of a natural guy who's always got, you know, butane this and propane that and water here. And because he's a disaster relief adjuster. He goes where disasters are for insurance companies after the disaster. So he's probably more prepared than most. And he said it's been terrible for everybody else. I mean, he's got a generator and space heater. You know, he's got it all. But he says, I'm fortunate because I was prepared. Most people weren't.
Yeah. Well, you see this more when you get older. You know, I went to visit my father-in-law, who's now in his late 80s, and he had a generator. I don't know if you've ever seen these whole house generators that you can buy. They're usually gas driven, but natural gas driven. The good ones have natural gas. So not that that would have helped you in Texas, but in most places, if the power goes out, you still have natural gas. And I thought, wow, that's really kind of overkill because they're ridiculously expensive. And then I took a walk through the neighborhood, and I mean, half the houses have them.
Well, my next door neighbor does.
It's a retirement community, you know.
Here in California, my next door neighbor does, and it's because her husband is an esophageal cancer survivor, so he's got to be on oxygen every now and then, and he sleeps in like a Barca lounger. And once the power went out, he couldn't breathe and he couldn't get out of the chair. He was stuck. So that got her to do the generator. And then when we had the roaming outages last August, we were having them over for dinner and our power went out and hers didn't. She said, bring dinner here. We have lights. We have a stove and an oven. It was like, all right.
You know what? Is that going to be the new normal as well? That we're going to have to prepare for that. The people in Texas, they ought to be outraged at the people that are running the power grid. But we should remember that a lot of these people that don't want regulation were also the people that 15 years ago said there was no such, 20 years ago said there was no such thing as global warming. Mm-hmm. This was just a natural, you know, occurrence of cycles on the earth. Look, we've got some real problems. money distribution is one, racism is one, global climate change. For all those people out there that are railing about, you know, us one-worlders, and I'm one of those people that's a one-worlder. I think that we should get the world together. That doesn't mean that we can't prioritize our needs, but there's too many problems out there that we cannot solve ourselves. We cannot solve global warming. It can only be solved by cooperation of people around the world. So I'm glad that we're back in the Paris Climate Accords. You know, I, for years, have been a fan of the United Nations. Now, there are people out there that will tell you that the United Nations never does anything, and I wouldn't argue that with them. But I will tell you that at some point in the history of humankind, if we don't want to perish, we're going to have to come together. So that's why I like the United Nations, because it gives us hope. And it's also one of the reasons why I'm excited that we landed on Mars this week, because I believe in the space program, not only because it's generated literally hundreds of billions of dollars in new innovation around the world, but also because I think someday we're going to mess up the planet Earth so bad that we're going to all need to find another place to go. Yeah. Not me, not you, maybe not my children, but maybe my grandchildren or great-grandchildren. So I hope we keep on reaching out in the universe. I don't know about you, but well, we're running out of time here, and I feel like I'm monopolizing things. So
what's your take on Andrew Cuomo?
Oh, I think he's right up there with Ted, you know? I mean, yeah. Really? You're going to cover up the deaths in nursing homes?
Because by 50%.
And how about all those people that lost people?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. And it was.
I have to admit that I watched his press conferences early on because they were on here in the morning. And then I would watch Gavin Newsom's, which was on midday. And then I watched Lester Holt's for my national news in the evening. And I've never been a news TV watcher until COVID. And I thought he was handling Nick Cuomo, thought it was great. And then this is coming up and I'm like, oh, my God, what? And apparently they said he didn't want to take blowback from Trump so that they kept those numbers hidden.
Well, you know what? There's always an excuse for doing the wrong thing, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Nobody ever says, "I knew it was wrong and I did it because it was wrong." You know, there's always an excuse for. And I will give it to Saturday Night Live. Their opening sketch last night.
I haven't seen it, but we have it recorded.
Ted Cruz and Governor Cuomo both were, you know, the butt of jokes, and some woman from The Mandalorian, but I didn't understand what she had done. So I guess I'm just not as pop culture as I should be. But yeah, they made a big deal about both Ted and Governor Cuomo. So,
and I guess CNN has told Chris Cuomo that he's not supposed to be interviewing him.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
but I don't doubt that.
Conflict of interest.
Well, right. It's obvious. And you know what? I got to tell you that years ago as a political consultant, I did work for him when he was a cabinet secretary. Not him, but I did work for Cuomo's consulting firm. And I did stuff from him. And the word from the consulting firm was, you know, kind of the opposite of what you said about old Rush, that he wasn't a particularly easy guy. He was not a nice guy to work with. I heard a lot of complaints about him. Although I have to add to that, I never knew the man personally, and I never worked for him directly. I worked for him indirectly. But there were a lot of things that were said about him that, to me, that he wasn't a very nice guy. Well, we've run out of time. Next week, we're going to have another, we'll have another guest, but we've run out of time tonight. So thanks to anybody that's out there listening. We're going to leave you with a song by the Youngbloods. a California group in honor of Maria Sanchez and people in the Republican and Democratic Party that need to get together, because that's the name of the song, Get Together. Maria, you get the last word.
We just are exceedingly grateful and thankful for you, the listeners, whether you listen to us live or you download us and listen on demand. It's a real privilege and an honor, and we thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, wait a second. I got to add one thing that somebody just emailed me. Mm-hmm. They said to solve the economic crisis, we should eat the rich.
I'm not in favor. That would be tasty.
I think I'm rich. I'm not in favor of that. All right. Thank you, everybody.
Okay. Bye-bye.